I think the tech is all there to be able to make some sort of device like that, at least to do like things at a basic level, like logging how you spend your time automatically. The question is, it's like, how do you ensure that all of that data is kept private? Because it's very problematic if all of a sudden you're providing a service to millions of people that are recording their entire day and someone like leaks that or is able to access that data.
How old were you when you started programming?
I was probably about 12.
Did you start learning in school, or what did attract you to it?
Yeah, so I think I used to be addicted to video games. Like I played tons of Minecraft, CS:GO, and so I think for a lot of people, there's like a natural like video game to programming.
Yeah, it's the classic nerd story.
yeah, pretty much. So I think that's a part of it too. My mom wanted me to code as well. She would, like, I'd play so many video games, and she would periodically like come into my room and start yelling at me and get into these long conversations about how I'm wasting all my time, and how when I'm older, I'm gonna regret it. And she was right. But she would try to get me to do these coding courses. It was actually Harvard CS50 at the time, was what she tried to get me to do. And it was just like, at the time, not as interesting as playing video games. But like slowly over several years, I eventually found that to be more interesting than video games, and then quit video games altogether. And then my grandfather also had a big influence as well. He always bought me programming books for like Christmas and stuff.
So, yeah, that's cool. It's nice that you had a very supportive family. And what are you doing right now? Well, what are the latest business?
Yeah, so now it's been Thunderhead, which has been the same thing for, I guess, 2.5 years now, since I was 15. And yeah, we're pretty much now kind of honed in on building liquid staking tokens for newer blockchain networks. We've done several things in the past. We've built like various different community goods, like dashboards, protocol contributions, block explorers, and stuff like that. We also had an institutional staking service for the Pocket Network. But now we're solely focused on liquid staking, and we have one launching very soon for the Chainflip Network, which is a cross-chain DEX that allows you to swap Ethereum for Bitcoin in a trustless manner without any wrapped tokens.
So are you guys like a dev shop for, well, at least now, for like liquid staking projects for young blockchains?
Yeah, pretty much. We kind of like to go into newer blockchain ecosystems, build out the staking infrastructure, which, depending on the needs of the network, can be either for just institutions, or it can also be like liquid staking for the retail side. And then also, if needed, support with various pieces of infrastructure that the network might need.
That's super interesting. Because it's like a fairly complex thing that you have to put together. So how does a 15-year-old get into that?
Yeah, so I mean, when I joined crypto, market was ripping. And so I think there were lots of opportunities everywhere. I joined the Pocket Network first. And immediately after joining, it was kind of a nascent network that was growing at a very rapid rate. And so there were just lots of opportunities to pick up there. We first started with a staking company. So Pocket's infrastructure requirements are pretty complicated, more so than other networks, just because you have to run the actual validator to validate the blockchain. And then you also have to run all the RPC nodes for the RPC requests that they need to serve. And also like the whole ecosystem as a whole is pretty nascent, and so there's very little public tooling available, and so pretty much had to build all of this stuff up from scratch. But yeah, that's pretty much what we got started with. And then along the way, there were about, I think, five or so different pieces of tooling we've built for Pocket as well. It's just grown since then.
So you started maybe with the, like, a lot of blockchains start with public grants and things like that. Is that how you got started, and then you just kind of progressed something else, or did you start offering those kind of services up front?
No, so just started with the staking. And like the staking was immediately profitable. So like as soon as people started to stake with us, we started to generate rewards and take a percentage of that, and that's kind of how everything was funded. A few of the things we've built have been like funded with grants, but a lot of it too is just kind of stuff we've done on our goodwill.
Yeah, that's really cool. You just kind of saw this opportunity and just decided to go with the grunt work, because I imagine there was like a lot of things that have to sit through to actually make this happen, especially in a young chain that doesn't have a lot of documentation and doesn't have like all the infra. What was like the
It was definitely a lot of learning. I mean, I went from like never even having a job to going from like zero TVL to 70 million staked in I guess less than 6 months. And so there's a ton of like learning I had to do along the way, not only from like a technical side with like dealing with Pocket and all of the associated infrastructure requirements, but also like learning how to optimally manage people and deal with clients and all of that other stuff. So.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. That's a pretty wild jump from in 6 months, especially at such a young age with like the practical experience in a lot of areas. I think that there was a lot that you were able to take in during those 6 months until now. What do you think have been like the biggest challenges in that period of like learning all this different kind of stuff and figuring it all out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the number one challenge is definitely the balance between school and work. Just because like school's always been my number one priority. In high school, like I knew I needed to get taught, like in addition to, I also wrestled in high school, but like in addition to wrestling and the company, I knew like I also needed to get like the best grades possible in order to get into MIT. And even now that I'm here, I see so much other opportunity that exists in the world outside of crypto. And so the struggle is like, how do I learn as much as I can while in high school and college to be able to maximize my like future potential, but also like take advantage of the things that are in front of me now. And so there's been like a lot of, like the hardest thing is there's like so many things I've wanted to do that I just, I'm unable to have bandwidth for. And so like it's hindered our growth in some sense, just because I can't be 100%. And so like dealing with that and optimally selecting the trade-offs for the things we do is probably been the hardest challenge.
Yeah, how do you...
And everything else kind of stems from that.
How do you juggle everything, like uni now and the business? I bet you have very little time for anything else, really.
Yeah. Like the good thing too is that I really like working. Like given, like hypothetically, if I didn't have Thunderhead or college, I probably would find a way to work on something. So that's kind of my like nature, and that's how I've been living my life for like 5 years now. So I don't see a big problem with it. So yeah, I mean, there's lots of kind of things that I've learned to appreciate more. Like when you're really focused on something and super busy, as you probably know, things like social interaction and like personal wellness tend to kind of become second priority, which is something I've like been working a lot on trying to improve, like focus on prioritizing like going to the gym or like dropping things to go like hang out with people for a few hours to make sure I'm not sacrificing anything too much.
Do you kind of have a set schedule of like, you know, gonna hang out for 2 hours this week with so and so, and then everything else is work? Like, do you have a pretty strict way of setting up your schedule, or is it just kind of more like a touch and go?
Yeah, it's pretty. So, like, I actually have a system I've been working on for this. I'm very interested, kind of like on a tangential thing. I'm very interested in like second brain software. So like, I'm sure you heard of like Notion, Obsidian. People have constructed these like second brains to kind of manage their life inside these applications. And so I kind of, as a side project, I've been working a lot on thinking about how like my mind works and how my mind interprets the world and how my mind is like making decisions for how to allocate time or what kind of things to work on. And so I've been like kind of documenting that. And so as a part of that, I track how much how much time I spend on anything, down to like a 15 minute granularity. So like if I spend more than 15 minutes on something, I track it in my calendar to monitor it. And then so like after a week goes by, I can look back at my previous week and see like how I spent my time, and if my time was kind of aligned with what I actually wanted. And then if it wasn't, I adjust that for the next week. So it's not like stringent, but that's kind of how I make sure that I'm doing what I need to be doing.
So you track everything in 15 times increments even?
Yeah, no, I'm saying like if I do something for more than 15 minutes, I track it in my calendar to like mark it.
That's pretty intense.
It's not that bad because like I do it, it's like, it sounds bad. Everyone thinks it sounds bad, but
not only really it sounds bad, like it's just things like twice something that never even crossed my mind to think about that. But please go on.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, I do it like twice, two or three times a day. Every probably few hours, I go back and I remember like what I did and I drag it in. It takes like 10 seconds.
Oh, that kind of makes sense because I was going to ask you about your bug report for the curve hack. Mm-hmm. How you have like minute by minute kind of timestamps. I'm like, how does it remember? Because if I was in your position, I'll be like just going for the motions and not really thinking about it. So I was going to ask if you have some sort of software that you're looking at, or just you're just like naturally looking at the clock and like writing it down as you go. So I guess if you already had that habit of having that mentality of looking and seeing how much time you spend on things, that kind of came more naturally.
Yeah, I think it's actually, I didn't remember any of the times, actually.
You just made it up.
We're in like a group chat. We're in a group chat, so every time I send a message, there's like a timestamp with that. So when I was writing the blog post, I just went back and looked at like all the messages I and the other people sent and corroborated it with a timestamp. But I'm very interested in time and how, I think keeping track of how you spend your time is extremely important. In some sense, like time and money are kind of intertwined, where we have like really complicated budgeting software that we use to like keep track of how much we're spending, but we don't have software that we use to like keep track of how we're spending our time. And then arguably the time is way more valuable than like how much money you're spending on meals and stuff. So yeah, that's another thing.
Yeah, I know, I agree. And it's somewhat really hard to track as well, because sometimes you're not conscious of what you're doing for how long until that time kind of passes. Have you seen Tab that, forgot his name, there's...
Yeah, Avi.
Yeah, this something. Guy. I feel like that's something you'd be interested in, because you can just say like, you know, time, whatever I'm working on.
Yeah, right when he, I got really excited like when he started talking about it, because that's like, that's one thing if I didn't have Thunderhead, like I'd probably be working on something like that.
Sorry, your mic is going wild, dude. I don't know what's going on there.
Oh no, I think I was playing with it. I was just saying that if I didn't have Thunderhead, I would probably be making something like that.
That's so much better. If you can just like keep it like that.
Okay. Yeah. I think it was in my lap.
Oh, that makes sense.
The Tab's really cool. You know, I kind of want to make one for myself. I think the biggest problem when, like, I think the tech is all there to be able to make some sort of device like that, at least to do like things at a basic level, like logging how you spend your time automatically. The question is, it's like, how do you ensure that all of that data is kept private? Because it's very problematic if all of a sudden you're providing a service to millions of people that are recording their entire day and someone like leaks that or is able to access that data. And so doing it in like a private way where maybe the user has sovereignty over their data is kind of the thing I'd like to do.
Yeah, that would be super interesting. I guess one way to go about it is doing it locally and having some sort of authentication parameter that, you know, only when you're wearing it, the data can be accessed or something like that. But yeah, that would be a super cool thing to do.
For sure. And then the other component too is it's like everyone using it has their own like their own personal model. So like when you're
when you're even when you're inputting this data to be aggregated, that's only going to a model that you have full control over, so you know that some other party's not like taking your inputs and using that for training or something.
Yeah, I think we're gonna see a whole array of different things that are gonna emerge in the next few years, of like, you know, all the way from everything being on one cloud and everything data and businesses just mingled together, all the way to just like local things that are, don't leave the device, and a lot of hybrids in between. And I feel like for convenience, I think the cloud one is probably going to be the more mainstream sort of application, just because most people don't really care too much. They're like, you know, whatever. It's, they just, people that are not very security minded tend to be more on the happy path, more naive to those things. But a local one would definitely be the way to go, in my opinion.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, we as a society have definitely made the trade-off of privacy for convenience a long time ago. So.
Yeah, going back to the Curve Finance app, can we can you run us through it, kind of, you know, overview, and then how it felt like going through it, getting, joining the war room, and the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. So anytime there's a exploit or anything, I don't do audits, I don't do any competitive audits, but I always find those types of events super interesting. And so anytime there is one, I open up the transaction in Falcon and see what happened. And I've probably been doing that for over a year, or probably a year plus. And so this time, when the Curve exploit happened, which for those that don't know, there was a bug in the Viper compiler. And the compiler is essentially what converts the code that you're able to interact with and edit and type into the binary code that the actual blockchain uses to process your transactions. There was a bug in that that allows you to re-enter, which basically allows you to, in the middle of a function call, restart a function call. And so attacker was able to exploit this on many different Curve pools. And then in particular, there was one exploit they did on the Curve ETH pool. And the attacker drained, I think it was approximately like $14 million from the pool. But they were a bit sloppy, and they left approximately 6,000 ETH left in the pool. They just didn't pick the parameters that would have been able to drain the whole thing. And so when I was going to investigate the exploit, because I had been notified about it like immediately when it happened, I look at it and I see that there's several thousand ETH left in the pool, and there's only 5 Curve tokens left. And under stable swap logic, the pool thinks that the value, so-called, of these two assets is the same. And so what this means is that, in theory, you should be able to swap a really small amount of Curve and take a very large amount of ETH out of the pool. And so as immediately when I saw this discrepancy between the pool's price and the actual price, I tried to simulate a swap. The swap failed, which made sense, like an exploit just happened. And so I checked the internal balances of the pool to see like kind of what caused the swap to fail. And I see that the internal balances are like ridiculously out of whack with what the actual balances are. And so I think to myself, is there a way that you can somehow get the pool to sync its actual balances with, or its internal balances with the actual balances? And turns out there's a function called claim admin fees, which allows you to, you just call it. And I think the purpose of the function is just to take the pending fees and send it to governance. But in the process, it updates the internal accounting. So I try to simulate a claim admin fees. That ends up failing again. I know that from like doing a bunch of fuzz testing with Curve that the when the ratios of the assets are extremely out of whack, there's like a rounding error that just causes one of the values to go to zero, and so it fails. And so I, with some trial and error, I realized that if you donated approximately 30,000 Curve to the pool and then did the claim admin fees, you would unbrick the pool, and then you could swap, I think it was 170,000 Curve, which was like $90,000 USD, for about 4,000 ETH, which was like 6 million or something like that at the time. So that was the first exploit. I reported that to the team, the Curve team. They implemented a, or not they, but I think it was Chainlight implemented a proof of concept. And then, unfortunately, you can read about it on their blog post, but they got front run inadvertently by publishing it to the mempool. So Coffee Babe, who is a generalized front runner, took these, whatever it was, 3,500 ETH. They ended up returning it, thankfully. But after this exploit, there was still 700 ETH left in the pool and a very small amount of Curve. And this is where the majority of the work was. We reasoned that if the pool can be drained when the balances are very large, then it can also be drained when the balances are very low. The difference this time, though, is that, even when the pool, even though the balances were lower, the internal balances were still like ridiculously out of whack with what they actually were. And so the next exploit involved some kind of donation, along with repeating the original hacker's exploit with unique exploit parameters that allowed us to recover the majority of the funds from the pool. That second process took about 6 days to do, whereas the first part was probably like a 2-hour period. And yeah, like that was probably the most invigorating and adrenaline rush of coding I've ever had in my entire life, especially the first one, just knowing like I need to like get this done as fast as possible because there's probably like 5 other people in the world who are trying to do it but steal the money. And so that was like a pretty big adrenaline rush. So that was that whole thing.
Yeah, so how was the whole like emotional roller coaster from like, let's say you look at it and you kind of coded up a proof of concept and being like, oh shit, there's definitely something here. And then getting hearing back from the team at Curve. Did that take long? Like what was going through your mind at the point?
Yeah, so I was really confused when I finished the proof of concept because I was like, there's no way. I was just scrolling on Twitter and then like this happened. And so I was like kind of shocked and surprised. I was like double checking everything to make sure I didn't miss anything. And so right after that, I tried to turn it into a flash loan. I wasn't sure like what the standard was for a proof of concept and whether they would want like a fully fleshed out thing. But after doing it, I realized that I know how flash loans work, but I've never used one or implemented one. So I stopped doing that. I made a tweet on Twitter because I had no other means to, ideally you wouldn't tweet on Twitter, but I had no other way to contact them. Ended up getting a DM in Telegram like 8 minutes later, revealed the exploit to them. And then they brought me into the war room where Chainlight implemented this proof of concept. And it was really annoying at the time. I guess still is annoying, but it was like super frustrating at the time specifically because Chainlight's like, hey, we're done. Should we send it? And I were like, yeah. And then all of a sudden we see on Twitter, someone tweets about that the second Curve pool just got attacked again by the front runner, and we thought it was maybe someone in the war room because it happened like right as we were doing it, but it ended up not being that. So there was lots of roller coaster there.
Yeah, and how was the whole experience of joining the war room? What did you learn from there? Like, how was that whole thing set up? How many people were doing different things? Who was organizing things? Basically, how does it feel to be in a war room?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not gonna like talk too much about like the specifics just because those are kind of like more private things, but at a high level, lots of interesting people in there that I've seen and known about, that it was interesting to like be working with them. And as far as things I learned, definitely that having a efficient like incident response plan ahead of time is important. There's like a lot of people who are talking about this at the moment. I think that's like the most important thing, because when something kind of catastrophic like this happens, it's like in the middle of the night or completely caught off guard. And then there's so many things you can do to prepare ahead of time for the worst case like this that just make everything so much easier. And so that's like what I'm doing for our things.
Yeah, I bet having that experience kind of opened your eyes to things you need to implement in your own business that you probably had no idea that are things that you should be worried about.
Yeah, definitely. Like I never really thought about like all of these things that you should have kind of implemented and planned ahead of time. And it was good to be able to see it and kind of know what to prepare for in case the worst does happen.
Can you elaborate on some of those things that you should have implemented, or in other words, give advice to projects that are looking to set those things in place, but they're not really sure what to do or how to set those things up?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of things. Not all of these are related to, most of these are actually not even like kind of related to the curve hack at all, but just things I've observed at all in like totality. The first one is having contacts with centralized exchanges and stablecoin issuers. Because oftentimes when an exploit happens, either A, the attacker like steals stablecoins and so they can be frozen. And so obviously like the attacker knows that they can be frozen, so they're trying to swap out of them. And so you wanna try to catch them and blacklist as quickly as possible. And so you don't want to be like going through Circle's or USDT's like public support when trying to do something like this. You want to have like a pre-labeled contact with them. Same thing goes with centralized exchanges in terms of getting identification if the wallet was like affiliated with a centralized exchange address, just because that helps. Like all of these things cost time. The more time that transpires after an exploit, like your likelihood of recovering goes down dramatically. So these are all things you can do to save time. Secondly is practicing with private RPC endpoints ahead of time. Turns out a lot of auditors aren't like fully familiar with them and how they work. And so like having a practice with them and being able to ensure that like you're submitting a transaction privately is a good thing to do. Also having like flash loan templates available on every chain, because that's something you can do to prepare when something happens. You don't want to be trying to like read through old documentation. Like we had to use Aave V2 for the flash loan. And so for the second one, and so I'm like reading through their documentation to like figure out how it works, I could have done that ahead of time easily. And also like I had to upgrade their interfaces, like the Solidity versions, cause they're old, which was easy, but could have done that ahead of time. And then I think communication is key too. I think Curve did a good job of communication, but a lot of times people, you want to like make sure that your communication is as like clear and succinct as possible, because any like exploits for some reason tend to be the most, I think in my opinion, like sensationalized thing on like crypto Twitter. Like for example, you'll hear about like an exploit for like 500k, but you'll like never hear about like someone buying 500k of something or TVL going to 500k. And so when you're communicating about an exploit, you want to be as clear and succinct as possible into like what actually happened, what users need to do, how it transpired, who's at fault, all those kinds of things, because things completely get misconstrued. And so like for example, I shared the transaction hash on the second Curve ETH pool, just so people knew that it was a white hat. And then like a bunch of people were like confused. They thought it was like a new exploit that had happened. And so like in hindsight, I should have like been much more clear with like specifically what this was, so that people interpret it properly. I think maybe there's a few things I'm missing, but those are like kind of the big ones.
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty good set of advice that people can follow. And if they don't have implemented all those steps, it's definitely they should look into. It is the kind of thing that a lot of founders tend to just not even consider, because especially if they feel like they're pretty secure, they tend to just not even worry about those things, which is so paradoxical because usually those guys are the ones that get hacked. I feel like,
yeah, for sure,
it's
hard to, and especially like in crypto, I think the industry would benefit a lot if everyone moved like 30% slower, because then everyone could like take time to do things properly. It's I definitely agree with that, and it's hard to like take time out of shipping products or new features or whatever other work that you have going on to like focus on like boring, like so-called boring things.
Yeah, I feel like it's a bit of a clash of cultures as well. Like a lot of software development is, you know, move fast and break things, and we are not really used to this type of responsibility of dealing with hard cash or like something that is as impactful or high risk as like building a bridge, which would have to have a lot of due diligence, or like building an airplane. How many checks and balances do you have to make sure it's right before you put a plane, on the air? We don't really have that sort of mindset when it comes to general software developing. And because it's public and anyone can deploy anything and anyone can invest in any contract on the smart chain, on the smart contracts, shits end up happening. And I feel like if you can change the mindset of developers and founders, maybe you can diminish the amount of hacks going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a matter of incentives too. And like the incentive kind of now is to kind of move as fast as possible. And so there isn't, it's like the, it's kind of like analogous to how oil companies continue to like pollute the world, where like their direct incentive is to continue with what they're doing. But kind of in the long run, that ends up being kind of not beneficial for everybody else. So it's kind of like an external cost you incur by doing that, not like a direct one. So it's definitely hard, but yeah, I mean, like there's some things you can move fast and break things, but when you have like people's money, like large amounts of people's money, that's not something you can do in the same way as if you could like some consumer application that doesn't really have anything at stake.
Yeah. Do you think there's any good ways that we could approach in changing these incentives, or do you think it's just something that's gonna, we're gonna have to wrestle with forever?
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately a cultural, it's a culture thing. It's a culture thing with the developers of the protocols, the people who are investing in them, and then also like the people using protocols. And so it's kind of a shift that needs to happen across everyone. So like users need to put greater importance on the practice, like the safety practices that a protocol has. And then like developers need to kind of understand that that's something that users want and thus make changes for it. And then investors should like understand that in the long run, companies that have better security practices may or may not be more or less profitable. And so that's, I think it's a shift that needs to happen like with everyone.
Yeah, it's definitely gonna be a gradual change and a lot of factors at play, but I also think that it has to be like a cultural shift. Otherwise, there's not really like other way to enforce it other than social consensus.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
So you're still really, really young, just starting university.
Mm-hmm.
What are your plans for the future, visions, things you want to accomplish, other businesses you want to start?
Yeah, my plan is, my long-term plan is to start several more companies. And then actually, I want to be a professor later in life for either math or physics. When I'm like 60 or something. But yeah, that's kind of my like long-term horizon. At some point I want to like work for someone else, another cool company for a few months, maybe longer, just to see like how other people operate. I think being managed is very informative in managing others. And so that's an experience I'd like to have, as well as being able to see other people's various leadership strategies. Yeah. I don't have any particular industries in mind. Maybe it's crypto, maybe it's something else. as I said before, I'm very interested in like second brain software, and optimizing human life. So that's an avenue. So.
Yeah, very cool, man. I'm excited to see what you get up to. I feel like you have a lot of time and traction behind you, so I'm keen to see whatever comes out of your brain.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Well, it's been a pleasure, man. Thanks for coming by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.